fictionalize it. But, yeah, I remember years and years and years ago listening to the good old Wesley talking to John back in the really good old days, and he was reading through. He had bought himself, I think, a scalar network analyzer, and he was talking to John about the virtues of a scalar network analyzer, which are few. I think scalar network analyzers existed because they were able to be built more cheaply than vector network analyzers. I don't know. Wesley, you remember the discussion on the scalar network analyzer?
Yes, I do. I had many of them. And I just have, I believe, only two. I don't have a scalar one. And long
perspective. Okay. Again, you know, nowadays they're kind of out of date. I mean, you know, if you wanted the scalar network analyzer, just don't look at the vector information from the display of your vector network analyzer. You know, back in those days, I'm sure that scalar network analyzer new must have cost someone $10,000 for some reason. But you know, now you probably couldn't sell someone a scalar network analyzer. I haven't done any research on it, but not quite sure exactly, except for museum reasons, why you'd want something as limited as the scalar network analyzer.
Comment.
Sure, Wes.
Before that, there was 4194A by Hewlett-Packard. There was gain phase analyzer. I still have it. That is absolute beast, and that is absolutely amazing stuff. You had a gain, and you have a phase, and you could have two different functions differently driven from the software. And that was 1990, I believe, or 1987, 1990, something like that. I have it. I don't use it much. But it does have impedance, real impedance measurement.
Was it able to give you its angle as well as its scalar component?
That is correct.
Okay, so it was pretty much a vector network analyzer then, right?
No. It wasn't on the platform of vector network analyzer. It was gain phase analyzer. So you had a gain, you had a phase, you had an angle, but you had two different screens. So you couldn't have everything on one screen. You had to switch to different screens, different functions. And if you wanted to have the impedance, it will give you all possible impedances available in that program. There were three functions, I believe, but you had to switch between them, big two.
Okay. I'm not quite sure exactly how that would work, but okay. God bless vector network analyzers. They take a lot of trouble out of measuring things. In the good old days when I was really serious, you know, I would every so often scan my antennas to see what they were doing, whether you know something had blown onto them or something had screwed things up. Unfortunately, I don't think I've used it in about a year or two, but it's nice to have it available. Anyway, any other comments? If not, I guess we'll move to our next person. Okay, well, our next person happens to be Wesley. So, Wesley, what's your questions or topics or comments for tonight?
I'm going to keep it short. Did not take too much of time. I'm still taking a lot of time. The ham radio related, it's mostly interested from historical standpoint. Quite interesting if we take and the evolution of its antennas in after war Soviet time. I sent you the number of links and information about European ham achievement in this area. So I hope you find it interesting. And there's a covert antenna. So let's say many ham radio operators have a problem with neighbors and they want to cover it. So there was a solution that was tried in, during the World War II. And one of the guys who was good in it was W1DCG. This is N2X again. And W2EEY. They talked about buried antennas. Some of them for regular use, some of them for emergency communication. The other guy was Peter Dodd, G3LDO, and there is an email in to this guy, somebody wants it, and he's talking about covert antennas, and they are underground antennas. So actually what I'm talking about right now is underground antennas. Something that I couldn't find in the browser when I was digging for it. There is a number of publications, but barely available. It is antennas of the Third Reich, so German antennas published by Ministry of Defense of United of. State of Soviet Union, so it's USSR, in 1948, there was circulation of 300 copies only of it, and you have a link to that too. And how come Russians have a hold of the Third Reich antennas? Well, they stole it, because often they do it. I'm gonna be gentle in words. Let me drop. Okay. And that publication actually shows that the closer horizontal antenna to the ground, the more horizontal component of electromagnetic radiation of the antenna it was, the less efficiency of the antenna was available. However, it was good antenna used during the Second World War by Russians as well. So if somebody's interested in those PDFs, Dr. Roy has them, and I have probably more as well of it. There were two antennas Russian military stole from Germans. There was Baza 500D and Baza 1500D. The antennas were used until the recent days. So it's not something that ended with the Second World War. It was used by Russians, let me drop. And it started with Germans when after the hurricane or snowstorm, they had ruined antennas. They decided that they want to build antennas on the ground or under the ground. And later on, the Russians found that it is good to have it, so they built the basis for it. There was plenty of those sites in Russia that were hidden communication stations. And one of the comments was, it was the end of 1980s during my trip by bus from Gorky, now Nizhny Novgorod, Russia, to small town at this region, while on the road to my destination, I observed a huge fence with barbed wires. I asked my local fellow traveler what might it be, and he said it was military communication site. However, I noticed that weren't any antennas visible. My companion remarked that they were installed underground. So the first time I had seen the underground communication site, and then there is an explanation how it looks like, how to do it, and whatsoever. Also, Canadian VE3KAO is talking about underground antennas and about Soviet underground antennas as well. There is available too. There was a number of guys, Russian guys, YL2GL, UA9FPQ, and they say that the station between the Moscow and Sverdlovsk, which was 1,800 kilometers, which is like 1,400 miles, was used on 3 megahertz to 6 megahertz, mostly in the winter time, but also from 4 to 8 megahertz in the summer, and there was contact communication A5S6. As far I'm not going into the details of those antennas because they are available in the PDF. Now, there was an antenna installed in military radio center and missile silo. There was 80s when ham radio operator was in near military base in the forest, and he was able to observe them. That was a quite interesting antenna. Imagine that you have a cup of coffee, but now you take this cup you flip that cup of coffee upside down, and you put the dielectric inside. And this antenna in the proper way done was also directional. So there was a number of antennas, some of them as big as football fields and some of them very small. Some of them were made from concrete. So it wasn't really that they were made from concrete, they were covered with concrete. And they still exist in Russia. And then they were buried in sand in 50 centimeters thick, so we're talking about 3 feet, not 3 feet, 2.5 feet thick. Some of those antennas were as heavy as 6 metric tons, 6,000 kilograms. So we're talking about times 3, 18,000 pounds. Okay, some of those antennas could still be seen using Google Maps. They still exist there. So I sent to Dr. Roy the picture of that underground antenna. If he has any comment on it, I will appreciate. If not, I go to the next topic. Dr. Roy.
Okay, this is AC2GS. I'll give you a little bit of advice, Wesley. Probably sending me an email with 20 links Monday, right after the previous TechNet, is probably not the best time. Because I counted up all the links, and I put it away for some other day. So, you know, try and send fewer than 20 links at a time. And certainly not a week before that.
Okay, I do it. Okay, the next topic. In household, home office, business, or institution, we often have some network-based devices that not always have Wi-Fi And even if they have it, those devices require power to work. So the method used now everywhere eliminates needs for outlets in specific location and cost of installing them, but not everybody knows that there is not only power over internet, POE. There are a few other ways of doing that. So let's say you have a need to power your cell phone. You don't have to look for an outlet. You have a Cat 5 and you could have it, or any other device with any voltage. But let me go to the explanation first. POE is a power over the internet, so it's usually 48 volts, and it is used for both data signal and power from the device to another over the same cable. So the cable could be Cat 5, Cat 6, and now it is a Cat 7. It is a little bit thicker, gauge 22, if I remember correctly, and it is not required. So a Cat 5e, that is the cheapest one, is quite good for it. So if you have a camera, CCTV cameras, or the voice over IP, or VOP phones, voice over IP phones, you could use it. On the article that I sent to Dr. Roy, there is a model of the device that shows how that could be done and how it works, and could be also purchased, but I'm not giving that model. I'm not doing advertising for the manufacturer. So POH, power over HD base T, enables transmission of DC power in conjunction with data signals over a single Ethernet cable to the distance of 328 feet. And it is IEEE 802.3 standard, so it's not something that we say is a Chinese junk. Of course, it could be Chinese junk, but it is at least with the standard. And then we have that what I was talking about, you want to have any voltage you want of your choice, and you want to regulate that voltage, you want to set that voltage at your need for whatever device you want. So it's POC power of a cable. If you put in the browser POC, it gives you different results, but actually I'm talking about power of a cable. So it works similar to principles to POE and POH. It is supplying simultaneous power and data signals over cable, Cat cable, Cat 5, Cat 6, Cat 7. But it does not have a standardized voltage and doesn't have to see the device at the end of it. So it is used mostly for proprietary systems, but doesn't have to be. And the voltage can be set to meet the needs of the specific product. If there is any comments, please, Dr. Roy or anybody else.
Okay, I'll go first. Power over Ethernet is not new, 15, 20 years, maybe, probably more. A lot of problems I've had with it. Number one, if you had a hub or you have a switch, you have to have a special switch that does power over Ethernet, because otherwise, whatever you plug into it, the power isn't going to go out of it. So you have to have a special switch in order to accomplish that. Then you look at devices. Most devices tend to be Wi-Fi now. They don't even let you use a static IP address. They assign an IP address, and they go into their little Wi-Fi-ness, and that's all she wrote. And the few that I've had that had the option for Ethernet don't have power over Ethernet in those devices. So there are places that sell devices that use power over Internet. As you mentioned, security cameras, very common, but non-security cameras, not that common. And a lot of other gadgets and gadgets that I have, not common at all. So it never really paid for me to swap out my switch with a power over internet switch, because usually it was about $50 more, depending upon the years. So interesting idea that, as far as I'm concerned, never really took off in non-commercial environments. In commercial environments, where you lock down all the equipment and it isn't a hodgepodge of technology like most people's homes are, you might be able to accomplish something. But in most homes, in my practice, it's just too higgly-piggly. Most of these things are just not going to come with power over internet capability, so why bother? But, you know, your mileage might vary.
Thank you very much for your comment. I use different devices. I use it in my network and the client's networks as well. And I also work with a number of universities, their servers and their computer rooms. It's a utility room, having all of the switches and everything there. Total colleges, I did a lot of them with my partner. But anyhow, I like it. The next subject is for Dr. Roy, because I'm not good in it. You are good in it. So food that I use in door trios make mice transparent. Stanford University had discovered the tyrosine. Now, tyrosine, a yellow-orange food dye commonly found in dortios that can make mouse skin transparent. So you could see, it's like the dream of invisibility. All of a sudden, you are invisible, but actually your organs are visible. And it's true, it's working. Science Journal offers a new insight for studying tissues and organs without invasive surgery. So instead of taking iodine or any kind of isotopes, and then your organs could be seen now, it could be seen without it. At least it was tested on mice, and they became, within minutes, became transparent. It is, at least the article doesn't say that it is somehow harmful, says at least non-harmful to skin, muscle, and tissues. So it's non-invasive and non-reliant on radiation technique. Dr. Roy.
Well, you know, I mean, it's interesting. There's a lot of things that are interesting. Is it of any particular practical value? Does it actually work on anything other than the lab rats that they experimented on? And is there any way of reversing it? Or how long does it take to clear from the body? I don't think you'd enjoy kind of having see-through skin for a couple of weeks. There are cases. We used to have a gentleman down south who took silver. Under some circumstances, if you imbibe too much silver, you get kind of a blue skin. So you look a little bit like a Smurf. As you mentioned, it doesn't make you transparent. It just makes your skin transparent so that you can better appreciate your muscles, sinew, blood, arteries and veins. I don't think that's a terribly attractive look, though.
Well, if somebody has to have a surgery just to see what's going on, and you have a tetrazine, also known as yellow 5, that can temporarily turn biological tissue transparent to naked eye, as described in study published in September 5 in Journal Science, I think that would be a better solution, don't you think?
Not really. About 99% of surgeries are below your skin. So being able to just look through your skin really wouldn't help that much. And usually the things that you're doing surgery at the level of just below your skin, you know, maybe removal of lipomas, little fat pad things, you don't really need to see it. You can feel it. So generally, no. Most surgery is done, you know, centimeters below the skin layer, where you'd still get no view because of your muscles and fat and all the other things that are between the skin and the surgical site.
Thank you very much for that. The next one, well, American Pride. So you have a building that could be a pride, like a White House. But we have a symbol that could be a pride, like American flag or like national item. And I sent to Dr. Roy and Paul quite a question. And I'm going to read that question, and then I'm going to read the same question in much easier form to understand. Would a historical event, now symbol of American pride, in New York, that is known to every single citizen of United States for a little more, that so it's more than 124 years, and is now taught to everyone in every single American school, has to do with a Jew who was a big-time bigamist, womanizer, having children with his mistress, too, and who was also accused by one of his wife of molesting his underage daughter, too. Anybody has any idea?
WSLN.
Go ahead.
I kept away from that one. I read the other emails. They were all pretty good. But no, I kept away from that one. It didn't sound like a good topic. Anyway, back to you, Wes.
Dr. Roy, you have any idea?
November 2nd, Victor Hotel Zulumobile with a comment.
Ah, welcome back. Long time no here. How you doing?
Hello, my friend in Gravesend, Brooklyn. Ken here. See you back in November in his car out here in Nebraska. I wanted to say hello in between Leslie's transmission. Every Sunday I try to get you, but I don't hear Brooklyn anymore. I don't hear the club, but I just wanted to let you know I'm on every Sunday. I'm 28385 listening for you. Ben, I'm alive and well, and I'm retired. Back to you.
Great to hear, Ken. I'm particularly keen that you came on tonight to say hello. I say hello back. Last Sunday, you might have had a chance, because one of our club members located in Arizona was able to check in. The first time in a long, long time. His propagation conditions have been awful.
Okay, thank you for that tip. I'll continue. I won't stop. I'll continue. I have a full setup. I have five stations, and I'm using my flagship every Sunday to listen, believe me. Last week I didn't. I have a friend visiting me after many years. We reunited. We're hanging out. Today I jumped on while I was doing some laundry. I did hear some guy in your area, but not in New York. He was in the East Coast. And I was hoping, beyond hope, that I was able to get through to you guys, but I wasn't able to do it. But it's nice to hear you, and thank you for letting me slide in here. But I'm going to continue, and thank you. Back to you. Back to Ned.
Yeah, you're welcome, as always, Ken. Like I said, hopefully this fall the propagation will improve, and we'll probably be able to reach more distant people than we had the last 3 months. So keep on trying, and I'll keep on listening to you. And thanks for coming on. Thanks for participating as usual, and we'll talk down the line. 73.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I'm no longer in South Dakota. I'm back down in the home base in Alliance. This is N2VHC Mobile, headed towards 15 miles east of Alliance, Nebraska, headed home. Bye-bye, everybody. N2VHC Mobile out with.
Okay, AC2GS here. Very good, Ken. Getting back to Wes with the question, I don't know. I just looked at that and said, do I want to be contacted by the Anti-Defamation League? And my answer was no. So very similar, I think, to Paul's reaction to the question. I don't have the faintest idea who the guy is.
Okay, so I'm going to give that question in a different form, with words somehow. How the Statue of Liberty can be somehow connected with a Jew who was a big-time bigamist, a womanizer, having children with his mistress too, and who was also accused by one of his wife of molesting her underage daughter. We need to understand that with 1800, so a woman could get married at 14, 15 years old. He was also an impresario, inventor, actor, a millionaire, and father of 22 children, but actually there was 26 children, with his six wives, who treated, and he treated them good and left them the fortune that is, in today's money, $150 billion. At that time, that was $13 billion.
Well, I mean, I'll throw it out to anyone. I don't have the faintest idea. I know, you know, my guess would be it would be one of these grifter guys that try and repeatedly sell the Statue of Liberty, because I know in France there was one guy who tried to sell the Eiffel Tower twice, and he made money doing it. But again, I don't know.
Okay, so remember that I used a word somehow. That is important. I'm going to go further. In 1811, there was a guy who was born. He was at first trying to be an actor, but then he made few inventions. One of the inventions was the machine to make a hole in the stone. There was no buyers for it, and there was a whole situation which allowed him to eventually sell it for $2,000 at that time. And that was enough for him to buy a house in Park Avenue in Manhattan, let me tell you. So what he did, and at that time the sewing machine had the banded needle, and there was a problem with sewing. So he decided to make some invention that was actually an invention that made him very much popular. And his name was known in all over the world. It's 50,000 offices around the world. He didn't invent sewing machine. What he invents is the foot. The foot that is holding the material and change the needle for the straight one. What was the name of this guy?
Isaac Singer.
That is correct. Isaac Singer patented his machine in 1851. But fact alone doesn't even begin to describe the individual behind this perfection of the technique and the process. So again, he was impresario, inventor, actor, millionaire, and the father of 22 children with his wife, plus four additional children, and he took care of them. He left them $13 billion, and he was treated them good. He was bigamist. One of the wives actually made him arrested for bigamy. He was born October 27, 1811, and I'm not going to go to his story, but the first wife was 15 years old when he got married with her, and if I remember correctly, she was 12 when he met her. And shortly after that, he met another one, and the first one find out about it. So usually the girls that he was marrying or having affair with, they were very young females working in his manufacturer in New York for sewing machines. The Statue of Liberty was created by the sculptor Frederick August Bartholdi in 1886. And there was another guy very much popular at that time, Joseph Pulitzer, also Jew, like me. But it says, the article says that it's true. Actually, Pulitzer saved the Statue of Liberty. Can you imagine that we don't have the Statue of Liberty? So in 1885, the dismantled Statue of Liberty was shipped to America as a gift from France. It was intended to be a symbol of American liberty and democracy, as well as a token of the bond fought between the two allies during the American Revolution. France had paid for the statue, and America should pay for the foundation for it, for the pedestal.
Wesley?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I got some problems with how much money did he leave to his family?
If I remember correctly, $13 billion at that time, which is $150 billion today.
Now you're off by a thousandfold.
Okay, so how much money he left?
$13 million.
Okay, so $13 million is $13 billion. So actually, it's $15 billion. Okay, so I'm wrong. Thank you for correcting me.
If you want to calculate what $13 million back in 1875 was worth, which was when he passed away, comes to about $372 million.
No, the articles that I was reading said about $15 billion, not millions. And it was, I read two or three different articles, but I actually miscalculated the zeros. So sorry about that mistake.
Okay, it doesn't make any sense that the $13 billion would go up to $15 billion in 150 years. So I would tend to believe this particular website. I mean, there's other websites I could plug it into, but it kind of makes sense that it went up by a factor of... Yeah, about 30, over 150 years.
Okay, I take it. I'm going to check it out. I know that the workers were working for 30 cents per day at that time. So take 30 cents per day and now take $6,000, or let's say take $3,000 and divide by cents, and you're going to see the difference.
Yeah, I mean, now we have a ridiculous number of billionaires. I'm not even sure if anyone was a billionaire back in 1875, but I mean, if they were, they were the guys who owned all the railroads or all the oil, refinery type of places, not a guy selling sewing machines. But still, a nice bit of change, both back then and even now.
Okay, Okay, thank you for your comment. I'm going to back to Statue of Liberty. So we're talking about Joseph Pulitzer. He was a very poor guy. When he came to New York, he didn't have a place to live and didn't have a money and became a magnate. Became the guy with big money because he was making a yellow gazette, yellow newspaper. Maybe Dr. Roy has a better description for it. It was a controversial magazine that was printing every possible rumor there, and he made a big money on it. So what he decided is that he's going to encourage Americans give donation of $1 per person, and eventually for the price that was offered, the price was the words that would be written on Statue of Liberty.
WS2N.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I just had one quick question. This is a puzzle. I know the answer, so can I ask this question?
Go ahead.
Sure.
Okay, it sounds like Wesley has studied the Statue of Liberty a lot. But, I asked this years ago, and I was in a large group, I was surprised that nobody had the answer. But my guess is, if he read all about the Statue of Liberty, he's got to know it. Why is the Statue of Liberty green? Back to you, Roy.
Okay, it's more of a chemistry question, but Wes, would you like to answer it?
Copper, Dr. Roy Beck.
Well, I mean, at first it was the tarnish of the copper. Then, when they fixed everything up, I think they just covered it in green paint to kind of simulate the copper corrosion that happened before.
No. It is not a paint. The paint was not allowed. The paint is only from inside.
Okay, but that doesn't make any sense. If that's what they did, that they reapplied a straight copper and then allowed it to corrode, then there would be a period of time that we would have seen the Statue of Liberty be copper colored instead of always green. Ever since I was a kid, it's always been green. So when did it corrode the second time?
Actually, that copper, it is good for the copper because it prevents further corrosion. As a chemist, maybe we have a chemist here to straighten me out in that, but I'm quite sure about it. And the thickness of the copper, French copper, was it wasn't 2/8, but it wasn't that thin. Back to you.
KD2VHD.
Yes, Jim.
So the green color originally was definitely the patina of the copper and the salt air. When they worked on the statue, they cleaned it back to bare copper and then used a chemical process like a salt brine or something that they concocted to artificially speed up the process to get that patina back. So they mimicked the natural process to speed it up and give it that green patina, which is actually protective when it's evenly distributed or isn't allowed to stay wet, that type of thing. So anyway, it was a chemical process to duplicate what had happened naturally previously.
Okay, very good, Jim. Yeah, I Googled it, and
apparently someone mentioned painting it, and other people mentioned what they would do to them if they painted it. So, yeah, they just accelerated the oxidation. It's a corrosion reaction. There are a lot of metals where the oxide is protective. The reason why aluminum it doesn't kind of fall apart is because it rather quickly picks up aluminum oxide protective layer, and that layer protects the rest of the aluminum from deteriorating into anything else. So, yeah, sometimes oxidation can be protective.
Anodizing aluminum and bluing on gun metals are two examples of that process.
Yes, that's true, but you don't even have to anodize aluminum. Aluminum by itself will spontaneously develop a very, very thin protective oxide layer. If you would like it to be a different color, that's usually when those measures are taken. Anodizing can give you a whole range of different colors. You could anodize gold and have it colored purple on the surface.
YWS2N.
Yes, Paul?
Okay, yeah, with aluminum, if you weld it, you know, you got a Helioc machine or something, and you start welding that, you look through it, through the shield, and it looks like a perfect mirror as you're welding it. And, you know, you use like argon as a backing gas, you know, to keep the oxygen away, and it's just perfect. The second you stop, and like you said, the second you stop and you pick up your shield, instantly it turns, you know, it becomes cloudy. It's amazing. But when you're looking at it, it's a real weird effect. It makes it actually difficult because you're getting a mirror effect of the torch, you know, that you're, you know, the stinger that you're holding in your hand. It's amazing.
Yeah, and we're not used to bare aluminum without that oxide. You know, when people talk to each other about aluminum, they always have this image of this kind of hazy, chalky kind of surface, and that's the oxide. You know, there are other metals that are much rarer, like sodium and magnesium, that have the same situation. They react with oxygen, so you'll have it in a glass bottle with mineral oil, and you pull it out, and you cut it in half, and it's silver, shiny. And then within a couple of minutes, it's oxidized, and it's that dull grayish color.
Okay, very good. I didn't mean to take Wesley so far off course, but thanks for let me jump in there. With the green Statue of Liberty question, back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. Wesley, well, a whole bunch of people had a whole bunch of things to say, so I thank you for that.
Thank you very much. So now we're going to the word supposedly, or somehow. Which is how the Statue of Liberty can be somehow connected with the Jew. Zinger. Okay. One of his wives, the last one, Isabella Eugene Boyer, who was 22 years old, and Zinger was 52 years old at that time, she became his wife. And she made him arrested for bigamy, but at the same time, the sculpture, Augusta Bartoli, decided to use her face or her body for Statue of Liberty. Now the question for you is a part of the puzzle, why I use the word somehow. Back to you, Dr. Roy.
I don't have a clue.
Paul, do you have a clue?
Oh, negative. You know, we're going to base this whole sentence, the whole question on one word, somehow. Back to you.
Okay. how the Statue of Liberty can be somehow connected with a Jew. So we know that the Jew had a wife, the last wife became a model for Statue of Liberty. Why I use the word somehow in talking about this woman? Okay. So, somehow is because when I was already sure that the story is right and everything is right, and really that wealthy person who, because of the Russian Revolution, lost all of his factories in Russia and all of his employees in Russia, made his own Russian sewing machine that was actually exact copy with Russian name. That's what the Russians do. I'm sorry if I offend somebody, but did at least. And I was so sure that I have a good story. I sent the sent email to Paul and to Dr. Roy. And then I find out that the information that the last wife of this wealthy Jew was the model for the Statue of Liberty, I found that this information might not be correct because there is no 100% evidence. They talk about it, but who knows how much that is true, Dr. Roy.
Yeah, Wesley, I hate to bust your balloon and Google you out of it, but Google kind of basically says Auguste Bertholdi modeled it after both his mother and his wife. I don't think he ever met Isabel Boyer. So that's just an internet meme as far as I've been able to figure out so far. There's absolutely nothing that suggests it.
Oh, there is plenty that suggests it. There are plenty of information on the website that suggests it. But if you go to other sources, you're going to find out that, yes, even there is a picture of her that says it's fake, which was the artist's work. It says not true. So it is like the information was pretty much widely spread, but actually there is no proof that it is true. But anyhow, I have another subject to talk about it. Also similar nature, let me drop it.
Wesley?
Go ahead.
Yeah, if anyone just kind of Googles who was the model for the Statue of Liberty, the answer being the guy who made its mother, Charlotte. There's a nice little picture that splits the Statue of Liberty's face with, looks like it might be a reconstruction of Charlotte's face. That kind of looks pretty identical. So for whatever that's worth.
Yeah, it says on the picture it also says fake, or it says a work of artist, depends what you're looking at.
Well, yeah, like I said, who knows if that really was her face, you know. I mean, unfortunately, we make all kinds of assumptions. A lot of statues out there have nothing particular to do with the way people looked. Some famous people did, but a lot of times, they'll be kind of possibly mythological. There are statues with the face of Homer on them. No one has the faintest idea even if Homer actually was alive or was just kind of a name given for a group of bards who would recite the Odyssey and the Iliad all throughout ancient Greece. So, you know, take it with a grain of salt, but it's an interesting little picture, nevertheless.
Thank you very much for that. And to Xia. Another one. It happened. Elon Musk finally reveals new Raptorized Starship. So, wow. Now we can bench the space-time. We don't have to really fight with the limitation of the speeds of light, and we can travel to any distance because Elon Musk made it. So when I was looking at it, I watched it probably 2 minutes, and then I say, I said a few bad words. I'm not going to repeat that, but I decided to read the comments. And then I sent the email to Dr. Roy, and Dr. Roy sent the email back, and then I answered that the reason for me sending the video was the point of degradation in quality of everything around us. The solid real American value from the past is not often present, or is some cases not present any longer. When was the last time you saw a word made in USA on the product? History Channel became History Channel in, not really History Channel, parenthesis or whatever you like it. Americans are pushed to accept garbage. I had different words, but I'm not going to use it. But on average, they eat it thinking that it is value. It looks, I look at the comment under the complete nonsense of and reaction people of that nonsense. They wow and their excitement of that rap drive of Elon Musk. Let me drop. So it is America of today. We want for our children to be like. Do we want this kind of information, this kind of thing, to be eaten by our children? So sources of innovation and products with solid reputation are mutating more and more because someone wants to save money or make money by lowering costs. However, it makes me aware of the fact that while in the West part of Eastern Europe, everything is now better and better. Quality of Poland is like a sweet cookie, prettier than Germany. People become more educated, and in average, in U.S., United States cannot even stay close to the quality of Polish roads, infrastructure, and quality, including aesthetic look and detail. It's a sweet cookie. So I drove 200 miles there, seeing no single piece of trash on the road. Can you believe it? 200 miles. Walkways, bicycle roads, green sidewalks, curbs, pavements, facades of the building and the house, everything looks like you're taken care of. So my question, I do thank you very much to Dr. Roy for sending me a quality video. And the quality video is genius behind the quantum navigation breakthrough. Let me drop it. Not the BS of Elon Musk. I'm sorry for the wording. So I would like to Dr. Roy talk about Bose Einstein condensate, death reckoning systems. Not units, what the NAT was, the localization of mobile sensors nodes were that reckoning, and eventually whatever the Dr. Roy wants to say about inertial measurement unit. Dr. Roy, please.
AC2GS. Well, I'm going to start this all in a very weird way that I wouldn't have expected, and no one listening to me would expect. Defending Elon Musk. Elon Musk had nothing to do with that YouTube. In the same way, he had nothing to do with there's a lot of AI videos that have faked his voice, and the voice says that, you know, contact me and give me $1,000, and I will return $17,000 in bitcoins to you the next day. So it's just a bitcoin scam. This also had nothing to do. It was pieced together by SpaceX videos and other videos of
theoretical warp drive engines that have no practical realization. But it wasn't his fault. This was just a bunch of people. Now, I don't think they tried to make money off of it, so I think it was just a big joke. And some of the people who responded praising Elon Musk might have been doing it tongue-in-cheek. There's a lot of trolling all over the place, not only just on the Internet. You know, recently...